1. The Wimbledon Art Dealer. "Influenza is unpleasant," Sherlock Holmes remarked, "but you are right in thinking that, with your wife's help, the child will recover soon." "I very much hope so," I replied, then stopped and gazed at him in wide-eyed astonishment. My tea had been halfway to my lips, but I returned it to the table with such force that the cup and the saucer almost parted company. "But for heaven's sake, Holmes," I exclaimed, "you have taken the very thoughts from my head. I swear I have not uttered a word about the child nor his illness. You know that my wife is away, that much you might have deduced from my presence here, but I have not yet mentioned to you the reason for her absence, and I am certain that there has been nothing in my behaviour that could have given you any clue." It was in the last days of November, the year 1890, when this exchange took place. London was in the grip of a merciless winter, the streets so cold that the very gas lamps seemed frozen solid, and what little light they gave out subsumed by the endless fog. Outside, people drifted along the pavements like ghosts, with their heads bowed and their faces covered, while the growlers rattled past, their horses anxious to be home. And I was glad to be in, with a fire blazing in the hearth, the familiar smell of tobacco in the air, and, for all the clutter and chaos with which my friend chose to surround himself, a sense that everything was in its right place. I had telegraphed my intention to take up my old room and stay with Holmes for a short while, and I had been delighted to receive his acquiescence by return. My practice could manage without me. I was temporarily alone, and I had it in mind to watch over my friend until I was certain that he was fully restored to health. For Holmes had deliberately starved himself for 3 days and 3 nights, taking neither food nor water, in order to persuade a particularly cruel and vengeful adversary that he was close to death. The ruse had succeeded triumphantly, and the man was now in the capable hands of Inspector Morton of the Yard. But I was still concerned about the strain that Holmes had placed upon himself, and thought it advisable to keep an eye on him until his metabolism was fully restored. I was therefore glad to see him enjoying a large plate of scones with violet honey and cream, along with a pound cake and tea, all of which Mrs. Hudson had carried in on a tray and served for the two of us. Holmes did seem to be on the mend, lying at ease in his big armchair, wearing his dressing gown and with his feet stretched out in front of the fire. He had always been of a distinctly lean and even cadaverous physique, those sharp eyes accentuated by his aquiline nose, but at least there was some colour in his skin, and everything about his voice and manner pronounced him to be very much his old self. He had greeted me warmly, and as I took my place opposite him, I felt the strange sensation that I was awakening from a dream. It was as if the last 2 years had never happened, that I had never met my beloved Mary, married her, and moved to our home in Kensington, purchased with the proceeds of the Agra pearls. I could have still been a bachelor, living here with Holmes, sharing with him the excitement of the chase and the unravelling of yet another mystery. And it occurred to me that he might well have preferred it thus. Holmes spoke seldom about my domestic arrangements. He had been abroad at the time of my wedding, and it had occurred to me then that it might not have been entirely a coincidence. It would be unfair to say that the entire subject of my marriage was forbidden, but there was an unspoken agreement that we would not discuss it at any length. My happiness and contentment were evident to Holmes, and he was generous enough not to begrudge it. When I had first arrived, he had asked after Mrs. Watson, but he had not requested any further information, and I had certainly provided none, making his remarks all the more unfathomable. "You look at me as if I were a conjurer," Holmes remarked, with a laugh. "I take it you have given up on the works of Edgar Allan Poe?"
"You mean his detective, Dupin?" I said.
"He used a method which he termed ratiocination. In his view, it was possible to read a person's innermost thoughts without their even needing to speak. It could all be done from a simple study of their movements by the very flicker of an eyebrow. The idea impressed me greatly at the time, but I seem to recall that you were somewhat scornful.
"And doubtless I will pay for it now," I concurred. "But are you seriously telling me, Holmes, that you could deduce the sickness of a child you have never met simply from my behavior over a plate of scones?"
"That, and rather more," Holmes replied. "I can tell that you have just returned from Holborn Viaduct, that you left your house in a hurry, but even so missed the train. Perhaps the fact that you are currently without a servant girl is to blame."
"No, Holmes," I cried, "I will not have it."
"I am wrong?"
"No, you are correct on every count, but how is it possible?"
"It is a simple matter of observation and deduction, the one informing the other. Were I to explain it to you, it would all seem painfully childish."
"And yet I must insist that you do just that."
"Well, since you have been so good as to pay me this visit, I suppose I must oblige," returned Holmes with a yawn.
"Let us begin with the circumstance that brings you here. If my memory serves, we are approaching the second anniversary of your marriage, are we not?"
"Indeed so, Holmes. It is the day after tomorrow."
"An unusual time, then, for you to separate from your wife. As you yourself said just now, the fact that you have chosen to stay with me, and for a prolonged period of time, would suggest that there was a compelling reason for her to part company with you. And what might that be? As I recall, Miss Mary Morstan, as she once was, came to England from India, and had no friends or family here. She was taken on as a governess, looking after the son of one Mrs. Cecil Forrester in Camberwell, which is, of course, how you met her. Mrs. Forrester was very good to her, particularly in her time of need, and I would imagine that the two of them have remained close."
"That is indeed the case.
And so, if anyone were likely to call your wife away from home, it might well be her. I wonder, then, what reason might lie behind such a summons, and in this cold weather the sickness of a child springs instantly to mind. It would, I am sure, be very comforting for the afflicted lad to have his old governess back."
"His name is Richard, and he is 9 years old," I concurred. "But how can you be so confident that it is influenza and not something altogether more serious?"
"Were it more serious, you would surely have insisted upon attending yourself."
"Your reasoning has so far been utterly straightforward in every respect," I said. "But it does not explain how you knew that my thoughts had turned towards them at that precise moment."
"You will forgive me if I say that you are to me as an open book, my dear Watson, and that with every movement you turn another page. As you sat there sipping your tea, I noticed your eye drift towards the newspaper on the table right beside you. You glanced at the headline and then reached out and turned it face down. Why? It was perhaps the report on the train crash at Norton Fitzwarren a few weeks ago that disturbed you. The first findings of the investigation into the death of 10 passengers were published today, and it was, of course, the last thing you would wish to read just after leaving your wife at the station."
"That did indeed remind me of her journey," I agreed.
"But the sickness of the child?"
"From the newspaper, your attention turned to the patch of carpet beside the desk, and I distinctly saw you smile to yourself. It was there, of course, that you once kept your medicine bag, and it was surely that association that reminded you of the reason for your wife's visit."
"This is all guesswork, Holmes," I insisted.
"You say Holborn Viaduct, for example. It could have been any station in London."
"You know that I deplore guesswork. It is sometimes necessary to connect points of evidence with the use of imagination, but that is not at all the same thing. Mrs. Forrester lives in Camberwell. The London Chatham and Dover Railway has regular departures from Holborn Viaduct. I would have considered that the logical starting point, even if you had not obliged me by leaving your own suitcase by the door. From where I am sitting, I can clearly see a label from the Holborn Viaduct left luggage office attached to the handle."
"And the rest of it?"
"The fact that you have lost your maid and that you left the house in a hurry?"
The smudge of black polish on the side of your left cuff clearly indicates both. You cleaned your own shoes, and you did so rather carelessly. Moreover, in your haste, you forgot your gloves. Mrs. Hudson took my coat from me. She could also have taken my gloves. In which case, when we shook hands, why would yours have been so cold? No, Watson, your entire bearing speaks of disorganization and disarray. Everything you say is right, I admitted. But one last mystery, Holmes. How can you be so sure that my wife missed her train? As soon as you arrived, I noticed a strong scent of coffee on your clothes. Why would you be drinking coffee immediately before coming to me for tea? The inference is that you missed your train and were forced to stay with your wife for longer than you had intended. You stowed your case at the left luggage office and went with her to a coffee house. Might it have been Lockhart's? I'm told the coffee there is particularly good. There was a short silence, and then I burst into laughter. Well, Holmes, I said, I can see that I had no reason to worry about your health. You are as remarkable as ever. It was quite elementary, returned the detective with a languid gesture of one hand. But perhaps something of greater interest now approaches. Unless I am mistaken, that is the front door.